Chapter 18. The Third Witness. The third witness. That's all he told me. So there was no other clue, she asked? No. And that was the end of the encounter? Yes. I headed back through the stalks of wheat to my car. The prophet remained in the midst of the fields. Halfway there, I turned back. He was still standing there in the distance, as when I first saw him. Do you need a ride? I shouted back. To where? He replied. I don't know. Maybe to the place of our next meeting. But then we wouldn't be able to meet there, he replied. I reached the car and turned back again. He was still there. I began driving away. I looked back one more time. It had only been a few seconds into the drive, and he was gone. So you really didn't have much to go on this time? No. The slightest of clues, and a seal I had already been given twice before. And I wasn't thinking about either, at first. I was still caught up in the mystery that had just been shown, trying to digest it all. It was about an hour into the drive before I began pondering the next one and the meaning of the seal. But I don't understand, she said. How could you find anything more? It was already revealed to you twice. What else could it mean? And how are you supposed to figure it out? That was the hard part. The seal was of the ninth harbinger, the scroll representing the prophecy, the vow, as proclaimed from Capitol Hill. The second time it was given, it still had to do with the vow, but now the repercussions of that vow, the Isaiah 9:10 effect. So what would it mean given a third time, she asked. Apart from the seal itself, I only had one clue. The third witness? Yes, but that's all I needed. How? The first two witnesses had already been revealed. And that was enough for you to know where to go? The seal was linked to a place. Where did each witness recite the vow? In the Capitol. Exactly. And just when it hit me, I passed a sign. For Washington? Yes. And you took the sign as a sign? How could I not take the sign as a sign? Now you're sounding like the prophet. My journey changed. I took the exit and headed to Washington, and specifically to Capitol Hill. It was a couple of hours' drive. When I arrived, it was late afternoon, early evening. I made my way to the Capitol building, to the same steps on which the prophet revealed the ninth harbinger. And what happened? What happened? What happened is he was there. He was already there. But when you drove away, he was still in the field. Yes, and there was no vehicle in sight apart from my car, yet he was there before me, waiting. Did you ever ask him how he did it? She asked. No. It was enough for me to try to figure out the mysteries. To try to figure out the prophet on top of that would have been too much. So he was standing there on the terrace, in the middle of the steps, overlooking the mall. The sun had either just set or was just about to. The wind was as strong as it had been earlier that day. I made my way up the steps and joined him on the terrace. You did well to get here so fast, he said, as I approached. But you were still here before me. Do you remember when we first came here? Of course, I replied. It was when you told me of the ninth harbinger. The ninth harbinger, Isaiah 9:10 in the form of prophecy. Here the prophecy was proclaimed on the day after 9/11. Here the nation vowed the vow to emerge stronger than before. 7 years later, the vow would be undone, with the collapse of the economy. Yes, he said. And what event more than any other would bring about that collapse? The fall of Lehman Brothers. And what decision was the most critical in bringing about that fall? The decision of the American government to let Lehman Brothers fall. And when was that decision announced? I don't know. It happened on the first day of emergency meetings in New York City, as the Treasury Secretary informed the leaders of Wall Street that the government had decided not to save the ailing firm. It would let Lehman Brothers fall. It was the most fateful of all decisions in triggering the collapse of the American and global economy. The decision was announced and sealed on the Friday before the collapse, September 12th. September 12th, I said. That was the same day that... The same day the prophecy was proclaimed on this hill. It was 7 years from the proclamation of the vow to the announcement of the decision that would cause the collapse of its economy to the day. So the economic collapse was triggered on the 7th anniversary of the proclaiming of the ancient vow. Just as in ancient times, the same vow would ultimately lead to the collapse of ancient Israel. A very dangerous vow. Nuriel, do you remember the biblical requirement of witnesses? He asked. For a truth to be established, I replied, or a judgment pronounced, there must be two witnesses. Yes, but another number is also mentioned in Scripture. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, the matter shall be established. By the mouth of two or three witnesses, every word shall be established. So too in the matter of a nation's judgment. The first witness appears on the day after the calamity, to proclaim the ancient prophecy from this hill. The second witness appears 3 years later, to deliver a speech centered entirely around the same ancient prophecy. Each would connect 9/11 to Isaiah 9:10, America to ancient Israel, and each would vow, "We will rebuild." Each unwittingly pronounces judgment on America. So two witnesses had spoken. But the scriptures speak of a third. So could there be a third witness? A third witness to confirm the connecting of the ancient prophecy to 9/11, but now also to the economic collapse. A third witness as a sign that the underlying course of judgment had not stopped, but had progressed to a further stage. Could there be a third witness to speak from an even higher level and on an even greater scale? Higher than the Senate Majority Leader, I asked. Do you know where we are? Capitol Hill. No, right here, on this terrace. No, I answered. This is the place where presidents are sworn into office. This is the place of the inauguration? The inauguration, an event filled with hope and expectancy. But in the case of a nation in departure from God and heading to judgment, hope can only come in repentance. Without a change of course, the end must remain the same, and all other hopes must fail. The third witness is the President of the United States. How? I asked. It's evening, he said. February 24th, 2009. The new president comes to this hill 1 month after his inauguration. He enters the chamber of the House of Representatives, makes his way down the aisle to the podium, and is greeted with thunderous applause. The nation's economy is still in a state of freefall, and a tangible sense of foreboding hangs over the future. Even before he utters his first word, the speech is being hailed as the most important address of his early presidency. It will be the first time he stands as president to address a joint session of Congress and the nation, and his moment to give America an answer to its greatest crisis since 9/11. The chamber quiets. He begins. Madam Speaker, Mr. Vice President, members of Congress, and the First Lady of the United States, I've come here tonight not only to address the distinguished men and women in this great chamber, but to speak frankly and directly to the men and women who sent us here. I know that for many Americans watching right now, the state of our economy is a concern that rises above all others. After setting the stage and framing the magnitude of the crisis, the speech turns. But while our economy may be weakened and our confidence shaken, though we are living through difficult and uncertain times, tonight I want every American to know this. We will rebuild. It's the vow, I said. It's Isaiah 9:10. And note the strangeness of it, Nuriel, the peculiarity of its appearance in such a context. We will rebuild was what was declared in the wake of 9/11. But in the midst of an economic crisis, it's hardly the most natural or the most fitting thing to say, except that it fits into the deeper mystery in which the two calamities are being joined together. And the president had no idea he was voicing the central declaration of Isaiah 9:10? Did the first and second witnesses have any idea what they were saying? No, I said, but they knew they were quoting from Scripture. Still, they had no idea what it meant. In the case of the president, he had no idea he was quoting from anything, and he wasn't. He was seeking to inspire the nation. Nevertheless, out of his mouth came the central declaration of the ancient vow. That he proclaimed the same words without even having a quote to quote from is all the more striking. It just happened to happen, I replied, just like everything else. It happened because it had to, one way or the other. The words had to manifest, one more link in the mystery, bearing witness that what started with 9/11 had not ended but was still in effect and progressing. It was now dark as we spoke on the terrace. The monuments of the Washington Mall were aglow with white, yellow, and orange light, as was the Capitol building itself. The prophet continued, "The words 'We will rebuild' had also manifested in the speech that launched the war on terror, the speech given by the former president. But in that case, the phrase was qualified and specific to the rebuilding of New York. But now the words would come forth with nothing to qualify or limit them. Simply, 'We will rebuild.' Now an American president would proclaim the central declaration of Israel's fateful vow as the central declaration of his entire address." "But with nothing to qualify it," I asked, "how specifically could three words be linked to Isaiah 9:10? "Good question," he replied. "Imagine this experiment. Before the president's speech, you type in those three words into almost any major search engine on the internet. 'We will rebuild,' just those three words and nothing else. What would happen? The search engine would take you to the ancient prophecy. That specific verse would more than likely appear in the first pages of results, if not on the very first page. That's how specifically the three words are joined to the ancient prophecy. But now it's the night of the speech. You repeat the experiment and type in the same three words, but now, instead of taking you to the ancient vow, it takes you to the words of the American president. As the night advances, you repeat the experiment. Each time you do it, you witness the president's vow progressively pushing the ancient vow farther and farther away from the top of the list. Or, to put it another way, the vow of the American president now takes the place of the ancient vow." So the mystery was now playing out on the World Wide Web. Before a global audience, through television, radio, print, and the internet. Through the President of the United States, in the hearing of the nation and much of the world. And just as it was with the first two witnesses, the vow would once more manifest as the climax and pinnacle of the speech in which it appeared. "How?" I asked, without coming at the end of the speech. Where it appeared in the speech was irrelevant. The President's address was picked up by news services around the world. Each had to choose a phrase to serve as a summation and headline. From the thousands of words contained in that speech, the words most often chosen to encapsulate and represent it were those of the ancient vow. CBS News, "Obama, we will rebuild." CNN, "Obama, we will rebuild." MSNBC, "Obama tonight, we will rebuild." The Guardian, "Obama, we will rebuild." National Public Radio, "Obama pledges, we will rebuild." Times Online, "Obama tells America, we will rebuild." Fox News, "Obama says, country will rebuild." Al Jazeera, "Obama pledges, U.S. will rebuild." Drudge Report, "Obama says, USA will rebuild." Associated Press, "Obama, we will rebuild." New York Times, "Obama vows, we will rebuild." Isaiah 9:10, "We will rebuild." From the New York Times to Al Jazeera, I said, they all chose the central declaration of Isaiah 9:10, with no one having any idea. No more than the one who proclaimed it had any idea. The same principle that caused the harbingers to manifest in the first place was now operating through the global media. And notice something else, Noriel. The president didn't just say, "We will rebuild." He prefaced it with this: "I want every American to know this. We will rebuild." Does it sound familiar? It's the prophetic address, that which comes before a prophetic utterance, to identify the person or people to whom it's being sent. So the word was now being sent to every American. "Correct," he answered. "The ancient prophecy was addressed to the people of Israel, and all the people will know it." So now the President of the United States is readdressing it. It is now given for every American to know. And as with the other witnesses, he too clearly identifies who the "we" is of "We will rebuild." The president is reciting the vow on behalf of every American. And by doing that, the president is in effect identifying America as a nation estranged from God, in defiance of his will and heading toward judgment. "Yes," said the prophet. Just as did the first two witnesses. In order for a truth or a judgment to be established, there must be two or three witnesses, and the testimony of each must be consistent with that of the others. To that end, the president added a second line to his vow. We will rebuild, we will recover. Why does it sound familiar, I asked. On the day after 9/11, when the ancient vow was first proclaimed from Capitol Hill, the Senate Majority Leader sealed the vow and his address with these words, We will rebuild and we will recover. So the president was repeating the words spoken on Capitol Hill, I said, the day after 9/11, but he couldn't have done it purposely. No, said the prophet, not purposely, but unknowingly, as with everything else. And notice, when the Senate Majority Leader proclaimed those two declarations, the words were not only being joined to the attack, but clearly to Isaiah 9:10. And now the president utters the same words, but now to speak of the economic collapse. So the same declaration spoken over the first shaking is now spoken over the second. The two events are again joined together, and it's all joined together by Isaiah 9:10. And they both made their proclamations in the same place. Yes, he said. The witnesses are joined together not only by their testimony, but also by the place in which they give their testimony. Each of the three witnesses proclaims the vow in the capital city. The first and third witness proclaim the vow not only in the same city, but also on the exact same hill, in the exact same building. And a building divided in two, into two wings, two chambers, the Senate and the House, the nation's two highest legislative assemblies, each of which must confirm a law or proclamation in order for it to be passed, as with two witnesses. And so the ancient vow is proclaimed first from the floor of the Senate on the day after 9/11, and then from the floor of the House of Representatives, first from the northern wing and then from the southern, one in each wing, one in each chamber, two witnesses. And did the president say anything else that linked up with Isaiah 9:10? Yes, with Isaiah 9:10 and with the commentaries. When the leaders of ancient Israel declared, the bricks have fallen, but we will rebuild, what were they saying? Tell me. They were saying that fallen bricks would not decide their future. The crisis would not determine their nation's destiny. They themselves would. From the commentaries. The arrogant response demonstrates how stubborn and overconfident the people of Israel were. They thought they could determine their own destiny. So after declaring, we will rebuild, the president gave voice to another declaration. The weight of this crisis will not determine the destiny of this nation. It's the bricks have fallen, but we will rebuild, translated into modern political terminology. And what did he say would determine the nation's destiny, I asked. America would be its own answer. The answers to our problems don't lie beyond our reach. They exist in our laboratories and universities, in our fields and our factories, in the imagination of our entrepreneurs and the pride of the hardest working people on earth. In other words, we will emerge from this crisis by relying on the greatness of our powers and resources. We will rebuild with quarried stones, I said, and cedar trees. Exactly, he replied. We will determine our own destiny. And yet the ancient vow boasted of more than that, more than rebuilding, and more than recovering. It was about coming out of the crisis stronger than before. Exactly. And so the president would add one more declaration to his vow. Listen to the words. We will rebuild, we will recover, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before. A perfect summation of the ancient prophecy. Now look what happens if you take the words of the president and hold them up against the words of a commentary on Isaiah 9:10. From the commentary, they boasted that they would rebuild their devastated country. From the president, we will rebuild, we will recover. The commentary, and make it stronger and more glorious than ever before. The president, and the United States of America will emerge stronger than before. It's scary, I said, how closely it matches. Much scarier, said the prophet, is what it all led to in the ancient case. And in the modern case, I asked? The answer to the nation's problems, he said, lies not in its powers, but in a power much higher than these. And until and unless that answer and hope are found, every other answer and hope must fail in the end, and the prophecy must continue in effect, along with the progression of judgment. The progression of judgment, so things only get worse? In the realm of appearance, not always. What followed 9/11 appeared to be an era of economic resurgence and expansion, but in reality, it was a house of cards. A very different dynamic was at work beneath the surface, and progressing, until the cards collapsed. The Isaiah 9:10 effect. The progression of judgment advances in times of calamity and crisis, but equally in times of apparent recovery, apparent normalcy, and even apparent resurgence, booming economies and prosperity. None of it hinders or ends the progression. Whether above the surface or beneath it, the progression continues. Then what ends the progression, I asked? Either judgment or the answer. And it's heading to which? To which end do you think, Noria? It's heading away from God. The progression of judgment is only a reaction to the progression of a nation's apostasy, its progressive severing of its connection to God and to the biblical foundation on which it was established. If the first progression doesn't end, then neither can the second. So the answer is? The seal, he replied. The answer is the seal? May I have the seal, he asked. So I gave it to him, and he placed another in my right hand. This, he said, is what I gave you at the beginning, the seal of the first harbinger. We now leave the mysteries of the second shaking and move to the answer. And as this was the seal that opened up the first mysteries of the harbingers, so too it will open up the last and the answer. And this one is like all the other revelations, or not? This one, he said, is unlike all the other revelations. And yet all of them are joined to it. And where does one go to find its meaning, I asked. Its meaning lies hidden in the foundation. The foundation of what? America. Where? In the mystery ground. Chapter 19. The Mystery Ground. The seal of the first harbinger, said Anna, was of what again? The breach, he replied. The opening in the wall. The removal of the hedge of protection. But there had to be something else about it, something you didn't notice at the beginning. Exactly. And did you find it? Yes, after examining it carefully, yes. It actually took a magnifying glass to make out the details. And what was it? A very, very minute image at the bottom right-hand corner of the wall, a rectangle, a vertical rectangle, with a series of points running along the top as if some sort of crown. And what did you make of it, she asked. At first, nothing more than that, a crown on a box. And what would a crown on a box signify? I had no idea, he said. So I went searching through countless books, collections, and compilations on symbols and imagery. But nothing appeared to match, nothing that made any sense. And then I found it, by accident. Not by accident, but by what appeared to be an accident at the time. I've lost my faith in accidents. So what happened? I was home, watching a documentary on ancient mysteries on television. And then it appeared on the screen. The crown on the box? Yes. And what was it? The Temple of Jerusalem. If you approached it from the front, that's what it would look like, a vertical rectangle with a line of golden spikes on top. And what did you make of it? There was the temple, and there was the breach. So putting it together, a breach in the temple. A breach in the Temple of Jerusalem? It couldn't have been the Temple of Jerusalem, he replied. Not literally. The mystery concerned America. So I took the temple to be the representation of a holy place, a church, a synagogue, a shrine, some holy place. A breach in a holy place? Yes. So I began searching for anything having to do with a breach in a house of worship and of significance for America. And after much searching, nothing. So I returned to Battery Park. Why? She asked. Because it was there that the prophet first revealed the meaning of that first seal. And nothing. Time passed. I was growing discouraged. And then something happened. A clue came to me, in a way nothing had ever come to me before. What do you mean? A dream. It came to me in a dream. Interesting. It was a dream of the Temple of Jerusalem. The day was sunny. The temple courts were filled with people, multitudes. Thousands and thousands of people dressed in robes, all gathered for some sort of event, some celebration. There was a procession. In the procession was a golden object. It had to be the Ark of the Covenant. How did you know it was the Ark of the Covenant? She asked. I've seen the movies, he replied. There were musicians playing trumpets and harps and sounding cymbals as the people sang in worship. A cloud filled the temple, not a regular cloud, but some kind of supernatural cloud of radiance. There was a man standing on some sort of platform near the temple. He turned around to face the multitudes and began addressing them. It was the king, King Solomon. And how did you know it was King Solomon? He was wearing a crown and what seemed to be a royal robe of gold, and I just knew, the way you just know things in a dream, intuitively. So King Solomon was speaking to the crowd and saying what? I couldn't tell or understand, but after he finished speaking, he turned back toward the temple, knelt down, covered his head with the golden robe, and lifted his hands to the sky. He was praying. He was leading the people in prayer. And as they prayed, I was walking through their midst, through crowds, toward the platform where the king was kneeling. I approached him. He was now just a few feet away from me, but I could only see him from the back since he was turned in the opposite direction. He stood up, still facing the temple, and with the golden robe still covering his head. And then he turned around. I saw his face, and it wasn't him. What do you mean it wasn't him? She asked. It wasn't King Solomon anymore, he answered. Then who was it? It was Washington. Washington? As in the president? Washington, said Noriel, as in George. He let the robe fall to his side, and he stood there on the platform, looking just as you'd picture him, a white powdered wig, a dark brown waistcoat and breeches, white silk stockings, and dark shoes with silver buckles. He lifted up both hands to the heavens, just as Solomon had done, closed his eyes, and began to pray. When he finished praying, he opened his eyes and lowered his right hand, as if reaching for something in front of him, but there was nothing there. Then a sheet of paper descended from the sky and landed in his left hand, which was still raised upward. Just at that moment, he lowered his glance and appeared to be looking directly into my eyes. He then descended the steps of the platform and walked over to the temple, still holding the paper in his hand. When he reached the corner of the building, he bent down and slipped the paper into one of the cracks in between two massive stones where it disappeared. As it disappeared, he faded away. I looked around toward the multitude, but they too were gone. And then what? Then I was alone, standing in the temple courts. The sky began to darken. The winds began blowing stronger and stronger. It seemed that time itself was accelerating faster and faster until all around me was a whirlwind of action, events and sound, an intense blur of sight and sound as the sky continued to darken and darken until it was almost as dark as night. Whatever was happening didn't seem to be a good thing. And then it was over, as if a violent storm had just passed through. The darkness began to break, and everything was growing brighter. But when I turned back to see the temple, it was gone. It was in ruins, its massive stones scattered on the mount. Everything was destroyed. It was then that I noticed a man, turned away from me, a man in a golden robe. The golden robe of King Solomon? Yes. He was standing in the same place where Washington stood before he disappeared, at the corner of the temple. Except that now there was no corner and no temple, only ruins. But it was the same place. At the man's feet was a sheet of paper. the paper that had been hidden inside the stones. But the destruction had caused it to be revealed. He bent down to pick it up. I felt I had to approach him, and as I did, he turned around. And it was him. Solomon? No. Washington? No. Then who? It was the prophet. The prophet? The golden robe dropped to his side, revealing his long dark coat. He looked into my eyes, then handed me the paper. I took it into my hands and looked down to see what it said. And what did it say? She asked. I don't know. Why not? Because I woke up. Bad timing, she replied. I don't know, he said. I think it was meant to happen just as it did. The mystery you were seeking, the prophet told you it was hidden in the foundation. So the paper in the dream, it was hidden in the wall of a building. That struck me as well, he replied. So you believed the dream was significant, a sign? I did. So what did you make of it? It all centered on the temple. The temple was on the seal. The seal was about a breach, the removal of protection, destruction. The dream involved the destruction of the temple. But what about George Washington, she asked. What would be the meaning of his appearance? Solomon was the king of Israel. Washington was the first president of the United States. There was something in the linking of ancient Israel and America, as with all the other mysteries. And the paper? As you said, the mystery hidden in the foundation, a message concerning America, waiting to be uncovered. So where did it all lead you? I had no idea where it was all leading me. And then it hit me. Washington! Washington hid the mystery. So the mystery was hidden in Washington, the city, the nation's foundation. And the temple was in Jerusalem, which was the capital. The mystery again pointed to the capital city. So I returned to Washington, D.C. But looking for what this time? For any connection to the temple or King Solomon. But the search came up with nothing. So I expanded it to include any house of worship of significance. But again, nothing. So I expanded it again to include now any place with a specific connection to George Washington, the Washington Monument, the statue in the middle of the Capitol Rotunda, and again, nothing. So finally, I just went searching everywhere. The Smithsonian, the Jefferson Memorial, the Supreme Court, everywhere. And yet again, nothing. So how long were you there in Washington? Several weeks. And then I gave up. I returned home, discouraged. The dream appeared to be filled with clues, but there was nothing to connect any of them to anything meaning anything. So I returned again to the only place with a definite connection to the seal. Battery Park? Yes. And that's where I was standing, by the water's edge, watching a seagull in the sky, when I heard the voice again from behind me. The prophet? The prophet. You haven't given up, he said, have you, Nouriel? Why, does it look like I have? I asked. I didn't say it did, he replied. You know, there's a fine line, I said, between giving up and having absolutely nothing to go on. So you think you have absolutely nothing to go on? It's not that I think I have absolutely nothing to go on, but what I do have to go on doesn't go anywhere. Then tell me, what do you have? The Temple of Jerusalem. The capital city, a breach, a holy place, destruction, Washington, D.C. And nothing else? That's about it. Why don't we go for a little walk? So we began walking, first through Battery Park, and then out into the streets of Lower Manhattan. The Temple of Jerusalem was the house of God's glory, said the prophet. But in 586 B.C., after centuries of apostasy and with no hope of return, the Lord finally allowed his house to be touched by judgment and destroyed. The temple and the breach, the destruction of the temple, that much I had right. The temple was the focal point of the nation's life. So the focal point of the nation's judgment would be the temple's destruction. Exactly. So as went the temple, so went the nation. For good or bad, when the temple's construction was completed by King Solomon, the kingdom itself was complete. Solomon. And when he dedicated it to God, it was the nation as well that was dedicated. I saw it, I said, my voice rising in pitch. What do you mean? He asked. That's what it was in the dream, the dedication of the temple. I had a dream, and it began with Solomon leading a gathering of multitudes at the temple. Interesting, said the prophet. Tell me, what exactly did Solomon do on the day he dedicated the temple? He gathered the nation and its leaders to Jerusalem. He addressed the gathering, reminding them of how faithful God had been to the nation. Then he offered up prayers for the future generations. Solomon was looking into the nation's future, foreseeing its coming departure from God and its consequences. The consequences being the removal of God's favor from the land, said the prophet, the withdrawal of his blessings, the nation's hedge of protection, national calamity. And it all happened, I asked. Yes, the prayers of King Solomon were prophetic, but he wasn't only foretelling what would happen to those future generations. He was also praying on their behalf, in light of what would happen, for God's mercy and for restoration. So he was praying in view of calamities which hadn't even happened? That was the point. It wasn't only the temple that was being dedicated on that day, but the nation's future, its generations yet to be born. The Temple Mount was the nation's ground of dedication. I saw it all in my dream, and after the dedication, the sky turned dark and something like a storm was coming. And at the end of the storm, the temple was destroyed. There was nothing left but ruins. Which is exactly what happened. A spiritual darkness engulfed the land, and the nation departed from God. And then, after years and years of mercy, the judgment fell. And that judgment was only complete when it touched the Temple Mount, the same place where the nation's future had been consecrated to God, the same place its apostasy had been foretold. The Lord had allowed the judgment to strike the nation's most sacred ground, the ground of its consecration. This, Nouriel, is a critical principle. Take note of it. When judgment comes to such a nation, once committed to God and once consecrated to his purposes, but now departed from his ways, the judgment will return to its ground of consecration. Or to put it more concisely, the nation's ground of consecration will become the ground of its judgment. Why? I asked. The Temple Mount represented the nation's covenant with God, so its destruction was the ultimate sign that the covenant was broken. Yet even in that there was mercy. It was a sign that God was calling the nation back to remember the ground of its dedication and consecration to him, the foundation on which all of its blessings rested. So it was both a sign of judgment, I said, and a prophetic message calling the nation back to return to the foundation. Correct. I took out the seal to look at it once more. But what does it all have to do with America? I asked. On the day after 9/11, he said, the Senate Majority Leader recited the words of the ancient prophecy at the end of his speech. But at the beginning of that speech, he cited a number. He said, "It is with pain, sorrow, anger, and resolve that I stand before this Senate, a symbol for 212 years of the strength of our democracy." Notice the number, Nouriel. 212. It was given to connect 9/11 to the founding of the American government, the establishment of the American nation-state. Do the math. 2001 minus 212 years comes to 1789. Correct, 1789. But I thought America was founded in 1776. The year 1776 was the year America declared its independence. It would be several years before that independence became a reality, and several more years before there was a constitution upon which the nation would be established. America as we know it, with a president, a Senate, and a House of Representatives, only came into existence in 1789. More specifically, it came into existence on April 30th, 1789, the day when, for the first time, all these were in place, America's first day as a fully constituted nation. What happened on April 30th? It was the day that the nation's government was completed, as set forth in the Constitution, the day America's first president was inaugurated. George Washington. Yes, He was part of it too, I said. He was there in the dream, at the dedication of the temple. First it was King Solomon, and then it was Washington.
Why do you think that was, Noriel?
Why was Washington in my dream?
Yes.
Tell me.
It wasn't my dream.
I don't know, I said. A sign that it had something to do with America.
What was he doing in your dream?
Leading the people in prayer, like Solomon. And then he stretched out his hand as if reaching for something.
Like this?
The prophet stretched forth his hand, with his palm turned down.
Yes, exactly like that. How did you...
But he wasn't so much reaching for something. His palm was turned down.
Then what was he doing, I asked.
He was placing his hand on a Bible, said the prophet, to swear. He was taking the oath of the presidency. It was the inauguration, April 30th, 1789, the beginning of America as a constituted nation, the foundation 212 years before 9/11.
The inauguration of George Washington on the Temple Mount?
In your dream, the two events were joined together, Israel's dedication and America's inauguration, the one superimposed on the other.
Why?
It was your dream. You tell me.
Because somehow the 2 days are connected?
But how? Asked the prophet. What would they have in common?
The dedication of the temple was also an inauguration, I said. And the inauguration of the American government would also be a type of dedication. Each was an opening day and a day of completion. Each represented the completion of a structure, the structure of a nation. And each involved the nation gathering together.
Gathering together where?
In the nation's capital?
And who presided over each gathering?
The nation's leader, the king, the president.
And in your dream, did King Solomon speak?
Yes.
What did he say?
I don't know.
King Solomon began his address by acknowledging God's hand and faithfulness in the nation's history. So on America's inauguration day, the nation's first president would do likewise. In the first ever presidential address, this is what he said. No people can be bound to acknowledge and adore the invisible hand which conducts the affairs of men more than those of the United States. Every step by which they have advanced to the character of an independent nation seems to have been distinguished by some token of providential agency. As he addressed the people in the days of the dedication, King Solomon offered up prayers and supplications to the Almighty, interceding for the Lord's blessing on the nation's future. Now listen to the words of Washington's first presidential address. It would be peculiarly improper to omit in this first official act my fervent supplications to that Almighty Being who rules over the universe, who presides in the councils of nations, and whose providential aids can supply every human defect, that his benediction may consecrate to the liberties and happiness of the people of the United States a government instituted by themselves for these essential purposes. In my dream, Solomon was praying. Then Washington took his place but continued praying. The two leaders, the two events were superimposed, so that's why. And it wasn't just Solomon who was praying for the nation's future, he said, but all the leaders and multitudes who were gathered on the Temple Mount, everyone. So too it was on America's inauguration. It was designated as a day of prayer and dedication. This was the proclamation that went forth. On the morning of the day on which our illustrious president will be invested with his office, the bells will ring at 9 o'clock, when the people may go up to the house of God and in a solemn manner commit the new government with its important train of consequences to the holy protection and blessing of the Most High. An early hour is prudently fixed for this peculiar act of devotion and is designed wholly for prayer. So on the morning of April 30th, 1789, the sound of bells filled the nation's capital for 30 minutes, calling the people to go up to the house of God to commit the new government to the holy protection and blessing of the Most High. As for the nation's first president and government, it would be later that same day that they would gather for prayer to commit the future into God's hands
at a place especially chosen for that purpose. So after the new president finished delivering the first presidential address, he would lead the Senate and the House of Representatives on foot in a procession through the streets of the Capitol, from Federal Hall, the site of the inauguration, to the place appointed for their prayers. And what was the place appointed, I asked? A little stone church. So the first official act of the newly formed government took place inside the walls of a church. That's correct, he replied. The nation's first president, Senate, and House of Representatives were all there inside that little stone sanctuary. The gathering would be recorded in the annals of Congress as part of the first ever joint session of Congress with an acting president. The inauguration of the United States as we know it began with a sacred gathering before God. So the first collective act of the newly formed American government was to gather for prayer. To gather for prayer, undoubtedly to give thanks, and specifically to commit the future into the holy protection and blessing of the Most High. Just then we came to a stop at a street corner. It's time, he said. It's time to uncover the last piece of the mystery. To do that, we must identify the ground. The ground? The ground on which America was committed in prayer to God that first day. But there's something I'm not getting, I said. All this happened in the capital city, correct? That's correct, he replied. Then what are we doing here? I asked. We were there in Washington, D.C., on Capitol Hill, even on the terrace where the presidents are inaugurated. Why didn't you show me this then when we were there? And even after that, when I returned to Washington, I was there for weeks and you never showed up. But you show up now. I don't understand. You were right, Noriel, he said. The mystery is linked to the Capitol. You just came up with the wrong one. What do you mean, wrong one? When the nation began, its capital city wasn't Washington, D.C. On April 30th, 1789, the city of Washington didn't exist. Then what was America's original capital city, I asked. You're standing in it, he replied. New York? New York City? The first capital of the United States was New York City. That's where it all took place. Washington was sworn in as president in New York City? Yes, he replied. Now I have someone to show you. Someone? He took me around the corner and down the street. There was a statue in the distance. Do you recognize him? He asked. Washington? Correct. It was the dark bronze statue of George Washington that stands on Wall Street, facing the New York Stock Exchange. We drew nearer, coming to a stop just short of the platform on which it rested. From there we gazed up at the dark, stoic figure. My dream, I said. This is exactly how he looked in my dream. He wasn't as big, but I was looking up at him, the same way, from the same angle. And his right hand was extended just like that. And turned downward just like that, he said, to rest on the Bible. I went all around Washington, D.C., looking for anything connected to him. A statue, a monument, a clue. And this one didn't even occur to me. And why should it have? He replied. You're a New Yorker. Just because something's right in front of your eyes doesn't mean you have to see it. Washington never set foot in Washington, D.C., but he set foot here. This is where it all began. This is where the United States of America, as we know it, came into existence. New York City. In New York City, and here. Here? Here, he replied, as in right here. There's an inscription on the pedestal. Read it, Noriel. Read it out loud. So I did. On this site, in Federal Hall, April 30th, 1789, George Washington took the oath as the first president of the United States of America. On this site. I've seen this statue so many times and never stopped to think about why it was here. Here is where it all happened, April 30th, 1789. The streets and rooftops are overflowing with people. Washington places his hand on the Bible and swears the oath. The crowd breaks out in cheers. Cannons boom and bells ring out across the city. Then he withdraws into Federal Hall, where he delivers the first presidential address before Congress. After that, he leads the nation's first government on foot in a procession to the Little Stone Sanctuary to commit the nation's future in prayer to God. Where? I asked. That's the key, he replied. The key to the mystery? I asked. Yes. It would be the ground on which the nation was committed to God, the nation's ground of consecration. Correct. So it would have to be somewhere in New York City. A safe assumption. And if we're standing on the site where the inauguration took place, and they went by foot to the appointed place, then it couldn't be far from here. No, it couldn't be, he replied. And that's where I stopped, instead of following it through to its logical conclusion. Why? Asked Anna. Why would you stop just then? Because I wasn't sure I was ready to see it, or to know what the answer was. But you were searching for it all along, she said. Yes, he replied, but it was never within my grasp before that moment. Did you ever get so close to something you were searching for? And when you know you're just about to find it, when it's in your reach, you're not sure you're ready to find it. I think I understand, she said. That's what it was. I knew it was something very big, very central, and very important, but I wasn't sure I was ready to find it. So what happened? She asked. The prophet didn't give me a choice. Come, Noriel, he said. It's time to see the place where it all happened, America's ground of consecration. Let's follow in their steps as the president led them through the streets of the city on foot to the appointed place. Let's go. So we walked down Wall Street, and then on to another. I could picture it all as it happened 2 centuries earlier. Washington, the first senators, the first representatives, the first cabinet, America's first government, all heading to the sacred gathering. But it was now just me and the prophet, retracing the journey. Not that there weren't others on those same streets. There were, of course, but not with the same purpose. I was silent the entire time, as was he. And then he stopped and turned to me. There it is, Noriel, he said, pointing to a building across the street. There it is, the place where America was dedicated to God. The place was surrounded by a dark wrought iron fence. Is that the same little stone church? Yes, he answered. The building was distinctive looking, and yet at the same time, in view of what it represented, inconspicuous. In the front was a columned, classical-looking facade. In the back was a steeple, tall, narrow, and more what you'd expect to find in an old church building. You might not even notice it, I said. What you're looking at, Noriel, is St. Paul's Chapel. It stands now much as it did on April 30th, 1789, when America's first government entered through its doors. It was here that the nation's first president, Senate, and House of Representatives bowed together in prayer to consecrate the new nation's future into the hands of God. This is the place where the new nation was committed to the Almighty. This is America's ground of consecration. Then he was silent, letting me take it in. But I knew that wasn't the end of it. I knew there was something to be revealed, something he was holding back from telling me. Originally, it faced the other way, he said. Its front was in the back. Its main entrance was on the other side. Let's continue our walk. So we crossed the street and walked along the sidewalk that lined the church's iron fence to our right. Within the iron fence was an old courtyard. As we walked, I found myself unable to stop peering through the bars at the trees, the grass, and the ancient-looking gravestones inside, looking for something significant in the mystery. I was still gazing into the courtyard as we neared the rear corner of the property. In the early days, the prophet said, this is what you'd walk through to enter the sanctuary. He allowed me just a few moments before speaking again. Turn around, Noriel, he said. I was so focused on what was inside the fence that I didn't notice what was surrounding it. You're missing it, he said in a more somber tone. It's right here, and you're missing it. Turn around. So I turned around. Look, he said. When I saw it, I was stunned to the point of almost losing my balance. Do you know what you're looking at? It's not... It's not what? It's not... What is it that it's not?
Ground zero.
But it is ground zero.
Ground zero.
The last piece of the mystery. America's consecration ground, he said.
Ground zero,
I repeated, unable at that moment to say anything else. America, he said, was committed to God at the corner of what would become ground zero. It was here, at ground zero, that they all gathered. George Washington, John Adams, America's founding fathers, they all came here to the corner of ground zero to pray on the day that America's foundation was laid, as the consecrating act of that foundation. It was here that they came to commit the nation's future to God's holy protection, and it was here where that holy protection would be withdrawn. I removed the seal from my coat pocket to once more examine its image. It was then that its meaning hit me with a new and stark clarity. The sacred ground, the nation's hedge of protection broken, and the ancient principle, the ground of dedication becomes the ground of calamity. The judgment returns to the ground of consecration. And literally so, said the prophet, as the massive white cloud born of the destruction literally engulfed the little chapel, and the debris and ashes of the falling towers covered its soil. So on this ground is hidden a national mystery. This is the mystery you spoke of, and in my dream, hidden in America's foundation. The prophet pointed into the distance. Had we been there on that day of inauguration, everything over there, everything beyond that point, would have been water. But between here and the water was a field, now known as Ground Zero, a field owned by a church. Ground Zero was originally church land. Owned by what church, I asked? The same that operated out of St. Paul's Chapel. So then it was, in essence, one property as one ground. As one ground, he replied, as one ground on the day America was consecrated there. Thus, it's not only that America's ground of consecration is at ground zero. America's ground of consecration is ground zero. The mystery ground, said Anna, softly and with a distant look in her eyes, as she pondered the implications of what she was hearing. The mystery ground is ground zero. Anna, you haven't said anything up to this point.
Because I've been speechless, she replied. It's so...
I can't even say what it is. I can't put it into words. I'm beyond speechless. That's how I felt when he told me all this.
You never went there before, she asked, to ground zero?
No, not after my encounters with the prophet began.
Why not?
I believe I was avoiding it.
Why?
I think because it was too intense, too raw, too much the center of everything. I avoided it.
So what happened after the prophet revealed the mystery of ground zero?
He led me around the corner and along the side of the dark metal fence that had once faced the North Tower. There was a gate leading to the courtyard behind the chapel. He ushered me in through the gate and led me through the courtyard, covered with grass and gravestones, over to an object that was on display.
Do you know what this is, Nouriel? He asked.
A tree trunk, I answered.
It's the sycamore.
The sycamore of ground zero?
What's left of it.
This is where they placed it, putting it on display for the public to see, having no idea of its ancient significance.
The sycamores have been cut down.
The sixth harbinger.
And on 9/11, where was it? Where was it struck down?
He led me back toward the gate that bordered ground zero, then over to the right toward one of the courtyard's corners, until we stood under the branches of an evergreen.
Here, he said, this is where it stood, and where it was struck down.
It was struck down inside the courtyard of St. Paul's Chapel?
Yes.
On the same ground where America was committed to God?
Yes, on the same ground.
So the harbinger was manifested on the nation's ground of consecration?
Yes.
And would that mean that this tree?
Yes.
What you're looking at is the tree that was planted in its place.
This is the Erez tree?
Yes. but we will plant cedars in their place. It was right here, said the prophet, over this fence, that they lowered it into the ground where the sycamore had stood, up until being struck down on 9/11. And it was here where they gathered to hallow it, and to name it the Tree of Hope. Yes, not much of a Tree of Hope. No. And so the striking down of the sycamore and the planting of the Erez tree, the sixth and seventh harbingers, were each manifested on America's ground of consecration? The ancient principle, the ground of consecration becomes the ground of judgment. At that he paused, allowing me again some time to take in everything I was seeing. There was something else in my dream, I said, something that hasn't been explained. Which is what? He asked. A sheet of paper that came down from the sky and into Washington's hand. On receiving it, he walked over to one of the corners of the temple, and placed it in a crack in the wall where it disappeared. And then, after the destruction, the paper reappeared, and it was you. It was me. It was you holding the paper, and then you handed it to me. And what did it say? I don't know, I replied. I woke up. Bad timing, said the prophet. The prophet used those words, she asked. He actually said, bad timing? Yes. Those were the same words that I used when you told me the same thing. Yes, but he said them before you did. So did he tell you the meaning of the paper? He told me it was a message, and the fact that it descended from the sky signified that it was a message from God, a prophetic message. And what did it mean, she asked, that it was placed inside the wall? It meant that the message was hidden in the foundation, America's foundation, on the day of the nation's foundation. April 30th, 1789, and the one who hid it was Washington, as in my dream. There's a prophetic message hidden in America's foundation, and it was placed there by George Washington, she asked. Yes, he replied. And the message was revealed at the end of your dream. So then the message is meant to be revealed? Yes. When? She asked. In the dream, it was revealed after a calamity that touched the nation's ground of consecration. The destruction revealed it. September 11th was the calamity that touched the nation's ground of consecration. Yes. So 9/11 somehow is linked to a prophetic message hidden in America's foundation. September 11th struck the ground where America was consecrated to God. It pointed back to the day of the consecration, April 30th, 1789. But April 30th, 1789 was also a day of prophecy, the day a prophetic message was given to the newly formed nation. What prophetic message? She asked. It was the prophet in my dream who handed me the paper that Washington had hidden. So it would be the prophet who would reveal to me the contents of that message, but not before revealing something else that happened on 9/11. America, said the prophet, was dedicated as a nation on this ground to God. But it was in Federal Hall that America as a nation was founded. On April 30th, 1789, the two places were joined together. And once more, on September 11th, 2001. How so? I asked. When the towers fell, a shockwave was sent forth from Ground Zero to Federal Hall. The impact was so great that it opened up cracks in the foundation. Cracks in the foundation? In the foundation of the nation's foundation? As if 9/11 was pointing everything back to that first day, to that first foundational day, to what happened at St. Paul's Chapel, and what happened there in Federal Hall. And what was Federal Hall? The place of Washington's inauguration and the nation's foundation. And where was that message hidden in your dream? In the foundation. And so it was there, at Federal Hall, that the prophetic word was spoken. By Washington, I asked? Yes. In the first words a president would ever speak to the nation. In the first ever presidential address. Just as King Solomon on the day of dedication gave a prophetic message concerning his nation's future. So Washington also gave a prophetic message concerning America's future, waiting for a future generation and appointed for the day of calamity, waiting to be revealed, a message less than 30 words long, and yet one of the most important messages ever given to the nation. And the message is this. The propitious smiles of heaven can never be expected on a nation that disregards the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself hath ordained. The propitious smiles of heaven, what do you think that would mean, Noriel? Heaven, I replied, would be a way of referring to God. Yes, and the propitious smiles of heaven would mean God's blessing and favor. Correct. And the eternal rules of order and right which heaven itself has ordained would mean God's unchanging standards of morality, what's right and wrong. Good, Noriel. Now put it together. What is it saying? If America upholds God's eternal standards and follows his unchanging ways, then it will be blessed with his favor, his protection, his prosperity. But if America should depart from the ways of God, if it should disregard his eternal standards, then the smiles of heaven, the blessings of God, will be withdrawn. Its prosperity, its protection, and its powers would be taken away. He's giving a warning to the nation. The day America turns away from God will be the day that begins the removing of its blessings. Correct, he said. And his words would be prophetic on several counts. America would be blessed with God's favor, as no other nation had ever been blessed. But the day would come when the nation would do exactly as it was warned never to do. It would disregard the eternal rules of order and right that heaven itself has ordained. Yes, said the prophet. It would declare those eternal rules to be an offense and would strike them down. And the words of the warning would come true. The smiles of heaven would begin to fade. The blessings of God would be withdrawn. September 11th, the removal of America's protection, the economic collapse, the failing of American prosperity. And each blessing would be removed on a site connected to that first inaugural day, the day of the warning, ground zero at St. Paul's, the nation's ground of consecration, and the crash of the New York Stock Exchange at Federal Hall, the site of America's foundation where the warning was given. That statue of Washington, I said, standing right in front of the New York Stock Exchange. It's a memorial, a witness of the day the warning was given, right in front of the New York Stock Exchange, the symbol of America's prosperity as it collapsed. A silent witness that the smiles of heaven were being withdrawn. We walked out the courtyard and stood by the gate. Look around, Noriel, said the prophet, as he pointed toward ground zero. When the calamity struck, all of these buildings, all the buildings surrounding ground zero, were either destroyed or badly damaged. All the buildings, except for one. There was only one building that escaped the calamity virtually untouched. It was called the Miracle of 9/11. And that building was the stone sanctuary where America had been committed to God, St. Paul's Chapel. It was another silent witness pointing the nation back to its foundation. How did it happen, I asked, that it was spared? It was a single object, he said, a tree. Not the sycamore, the sycamore of ground zero, the harbinger. The sycamore was credited with having shielded the chapel both from the force of the implosion and the flying wreckage of the falling towers. So the chapel was saved from destruction by the harbinger? Does that seem strange, he asked. I don't know. The purpose of the harbingers is not to condemn America to judgment, but to save it, to give it warning, to awaken it, and to turn it back from destruction. The sixth harbinger saved the chapel. So too, redemption comes not only apart from calamity, but also through it. We resumed walking alongside the wrought iron fence and around the courtyard. In the days after 9/11, a strange thing happened. People from all over the city and all over the nation were drawn here. First were the relief workers who used the chapel as a center for emergency operations. But then came the others, the grieving, the hurting, the curious, those seeking an answer. The chapel and the land on which it stood became the spiritual focal point of the calamity. Some wandered through the courtyard seeking consolation. Others entered the sanctuary. This iron fence was covered over with pictures, messages, and objects of faith. And it wasn't that anyone fully knew exactly what it was that drew them there. It had nothing to do with anything taking place within its walls, or with those now overseeing or officiating over its functions. It had to do with the place itself. There was something about it. And so they returned, unknowingly, to pray on the same ground on which the nation's first leaders had also prayed on the day of the prophetic warning, which had now come to pass. It's as if behind everything, behind Ground Zero, behind Federal Hall, behind the chapel, behind the harbingers, behind everything is the word return. Not as if, Noriel. It is the word behind everything. It's the word of the prophets. Behind every mystery and harbinger, a voice was calling the nation back to God and crying out, return.